Sarah, your choice is to go around, puck away one more time, and assess after that. Makes a lot of sense for a lower time pilot who's clearly feeling overwhelmed. This is ridiculous, they were saying. You also said that even for you, as a high time pilot, designated examiner, ferry pilot, airline pilot, lots of experience, has been to Oshkosh many times, you're going around one more time. What is it for you that says, no, I'm not ready to go in, given you have much more at your disposal than the scenario pilot in terms of experience and skills?
For me, the biggest point in this scenario is being predictable. I have somebody behind me who has seen me start the turn, and they might continue in the hold as well, or they might continue down on the way to Ripon, and now they've seen me turn, and now all of a sudden to make a banking maneuver back to try to join the original path inbound to me would be unpredictable for other traffic in the area.
So it's less about you, and it's more about the community, it sounds like, right?
Yeah. I think it's a little bit of both. Okay. I would probably also venture to say that since the path is not much different than the published procedure, if there was no traffic, I might have a different scenario. But because of the amount of traffic saturation and dealing with the weather and all these other factors would be the reason that I would continue into the hold.
Tom, you're also going around one more time. Is it about predictability for the most part, or is it really a combination, and what are the factors in your decision?
Well, predictability is part of it, but we've got a lot of people going around in circles here, and there may be an airplane that is spacing off of me that doesn't even have ADS-B. I don't know what's out there, but somebody's following me. I begin a left-hand turn. If I immediately make a right-hand turn and they are already at that one-half-mile space behind me, I'm going to reduce that spacing. So it's predictability, but it's also there may be a target back there, and now I'm messing up this spacing because I have tried to shortcut the process.
Richard, you actually surprised me with your choice to go inbound, technically against the procedure. Tell me why.
Yeah.
Why is that?
It's because I think it's what's best for the situation. So it's situational dependent. There's certainly nothing wrong, and it's probably the more technically correct answer to keep going in the holding. In this case, though, if you look at the broader picture, the reason why Oshkosh arrival works miraculously almost year after year is because a combination of pilot judgment, pilots using good see and avoid techniques to do the right thing in a very fluid situation, and controllers helping and assisting. It's not the other way around. Controllers guiding and procedures guiding. It really works because of pilot judgment and see and avoid. So if I look at this situation, to me, it makes the most sense for the flow of the entire Oshkosh arrival. There's a gap right there that I can take advantage of, and everybody will be thankful I did. And by the way, I've flown in that arrival a lot, as everybody around this table has. I've seen a bunch of people make a bunch of heading changes more than 20 degrees trying to hold that pattern, so I'm not sure it would be that much of a distraction.
Dave, you're also heading inbound and have lots of experience with this.
Yeah, I'm heading inbound because it's the conservative choice. This situation doesn't get better with more circling. As Richard pointed out, system-wise, there are more airplanes arrival. This holding pattern is more and more crowded. There's a gap. You know, nature abhors a vacuum. I'm going to fill that gap. I'm not going to waste runway. I'm not going to waste space. I'm going to, you know, the spacing is adequate with the airplane in front, and I'm going to get in line.
So let me stay with you just one bit on that. You have adequate spacing with the airplane in front. What about an airplane behind you in the gap that Sarah had mentioned the potential for and Richard had just brought up, Tom had brought up, that an ADS-B, non-ADS-B target behind you could be right on your tail?
Could be, but it's like if an airplane behind me is flying off me, then, a course reversal, you know, a 20-degree heading change, you know, shouldn't be critical.
Is there a point, and what is it in how much you've turned, that you would keep going? Because that is the procedure. Obviously, if you were 90 degrees turned, you're committed. If you hadn't turned, you're going in. Barely turned, the safer thing is going in. Is there a real line that you can say?
Yeah,
or is it
no,
so
I'm just,
situationally dependent?
I'm looking at the gap between me and the airplane in front of me. And if I can fill it, if the space is adequate, I'll take it. and I'll vacate the airspace because there's hundreds of people behind me waiting to, you know, waiting for me to fill that. You know, if we're in a IFR scenario and we're waiting for weather and we're, you know, more turns in the hold, let's let the situation settle down. That is a totally different scenario than this. This is be part of this system. Don't let, you know, fill the gaps, clear the airspace.
Sarah.
So one thing to think about, too, is that in my experience, whenever I've flown into Oshkosh and you've had one of these scenarios where the weather's been bad and everybody's been waiting and people are in the hold, is that you have about 45 minutes of madness and then things kind of calm down. That's been my experience. So that being said, while holding in the hold at Puckaway Lake, there's probably going to be a lot less traffic. I know that when I see the Congo line and the traffic saturation, I'm sitting there on the ground at one of the nearby airports, and they say, oh, well, now Oshkosh is open. Well, that's the time to fire up. So a lot of the people that are likely holding are going to be, because since the holding entry point right now is Puckaway Lake, they'll be doing the hold around Puckaway Lake, and there won't be people behind you until they just join naturally. So in my opinion, an additional hold around Puckaway Lake would give traffic an opportunity to become a little bit less dense.
JP.
You know, I've never flown into Oshkosh before, so this is very intriguing, if not a little bit on the scary side. My first option, I'm just going to go somewhere else. This is a lot of traffic. But looking at this scenario, I see going inbound as a way to declutter the situation, almost a way to improve the efficiency to get out of that hold. And I know I'm in a turn, but I'm almost like in a bank there that's just started. If I were really committed to that turn, like some of the others said, at a 90 degree, I'm going to stay in there. At this point, just going inbound seems like the easiest way to relieve some of the traffic in that hold. And it looks like, based on what I'm seeing from the ADS-B data, that there's significant spacing between me and the other traffic that's inbound. So that's what I would do in that situation, based on what I'm seeing here.
So I appreciate having people at the table who haven't been, as well as people who have been many, many, many times, because that's the environment of the actual pilots. Some of them are first-time pilots. Some of them have done it many times. Kevin, you're the controller at the table here. Procedures, you know, keep the airplanes apart, but you're going inbound in this case. Same reasons as everyone else, or is there something new? And you haven't been to Oshkosh before, so we toss this on you. Without the experience, you've just got this to look at. Tell me about it.
Well, for me, yes, I'm making that shallow 20-ish degree turn and continuing inbound for sure. Part of being a controller is I approach things with a thought process of safe, orderly, and expeditious. And that's sort of what we do in the ATC world. That's how it's supposed to work. In this case, I look at the shallow turn going in as it's safe because I'm occupying space in the line that works very well for me. It's orderly because I'm basically staying in line. People behind me are staying in line. Otherwise, it's not one more airplane going around the lake while there's more airplanes coming inbound to circle that lake. And it's expeditious for everybody because it is well organized. So to that end, I think it works well. It's a good flow. If it was a lot more of a turn, then I probably wouldn't for the reasons that other people have stated. But no, I'm turning inbound, but also turning inbound, having my head on a swivel, because that's what you're going to do the whole time going into Oshkosh, looking at the spacing with the airplane in front of me. And I might even accelerate just a little bit, even just 5 knots, 8 knots, something like that, just to have that nice, consistent interval that helps everything flow so well.
You know, and I want to be careful here as we're talking about this, because I love that we're having a really honest discussion. But at the same time, I don't want to say that any of us are advocating not following the procedure going into Oshkosh, because that is what keeps us safe. But where I think I'd like to go next is that the procedure is a framework to work with. You still have to make good decisions based on what's happening in the moment. That's what you brought up, Richard. Every pilot is trying to keep themselves orderly and safe in that, recognizing what's going on around them. And those two things have to happen simultaneously. That's part of where the overwhelm is. Kevin, you had something to add there.
Yeah, I think the shallow turn to go inbound sticks with the spirit of the procedure, if not the absolute black and white of it. And I generally don't want to have a fanatical devotion to the black and white of things. I'd much rather stick with the spirit of it, even if the spirit of it might necessarily be in compliance, but could still be not the greatest thing to do for everybody around me.
Richard.
Yeah, Kevin said it better than I did. I think that procedure helps. Like you said, it's a framework built at zero knots in 1G, right? Mm-hmm. Now you're in this fluid dynamic environment where it's required of you to use your pilot judgment to help this flow out. The Oshkosh arrival would not work just based on a pure procedure if it weren't for pilots not using good judgment. I bet everybody in here has got a story about being overrun on the arrival or somebody passing under them or, you know, something.
Tom, do you agree with that, that the pilot judgment is a key factor in making this whole thing work?
Yeah, I do agree. And I also agree that turning inbound might well be with the spirit. And my choice to continue one more turn around the hold isn't because that's what the procedure says to do. It's because I've had some of these conflicts coming into Oshkosh, and I don't know who's behind me. If I've made 20 degrees worth of heading change, we're not talking about 20 degrees bank, we're talking I've Correct. Completed 20 degrees of heading change, to get back over that line that I'm supposed to be across the ground, I don't just turn 20 to the right. I've got to turn like 40 to the right, go over, and then turn 20 to the left. I'm going to reduce quite a bit the spacing between the airplane behind me and me. And if there's someone that I can't see behind me, it may become critical if I do that.
Sarah?
I do also agree with a lot of people here who are talking about how important it is to use judgment. And I'm not saying that in all scenarios that the procedure is always the best. I mean, there's plenty of times where I've had to personally declare an emergency or deviate from a procedure for the interest of safety. And there's nothing wrong with doing something that could potentially decrease your workload when you're already getting overwhelmed. And I've got no problems with that whatsoever. That being said, you know, what Tom said, it's very important now, since you do have so many people behind you in such close spacing, to really be following that to the T, because once again, the person behind you, maybe it's the person you see on ADS-B, maybe there's somebody in between, they're going to be expecting you to continue instead of banking hard and almost cutting right in front of them.
Just for clarification, you've never had to declare an emergency or deviate from the procedure at Oshkosh. This is in your other flying life, right? There are other times that that's happened. I just want to make sure that unless you're saying you have had to declare an emergency going into Oshkosh.
No, I've never had to declare an emergency going into Oshkosh. Okay. But in generally speaking, at any time in your mind as a pilot in command, you question the outcome or the safety of the flight, you should not hesitate to deviate from a procedure.
Richard.
I think that's such an important point Sarah made. I want to stress that when pilots get airborne and they're in some kind of sticky situation, the first thought not should be what's legal. The first thought should be what's safe. And that's probably also what's legal, but you'll be able to explain why you did what you did because it was the safest outcome. So that's got to be the priority.
Tom.
Well, I have had to deviate going into Oshkosh. I did it this year. I was inbound. I was on the 1,800-foot pattern, and I could see coming up from about my 4 o'clock position an ADS-B target coming in very, very fast. The first time I saw him, he was at about 6 miles out and 400 feet above me descending. Then he was at 5 miles out and 300 feet and closer and closer and closer, and he was in my blind spot off the right-hand side. I could not see this aircraft. When the airplane got within a mile and within 100 feet of me, I chopped the throttle, I banked hard to the right so I'd pass, I would try to get that person in my windshield, but I dove out of the pattern and down to about 600 feet above ground level. Wow. As I rolled into that turn and all three of my screens started to flash that ADS-B conflict alert, I could see basically from the center line out to the right wing of a twin coming in very fast out my right windows. So I have had to deviate. And maybe that's part of why I would choose to be more conservative and continue the turn that I had started, because I didn't know what was behind me and I could barely see at the last minute what was behind me then. And I'm wondering what might be behind me in the scenario now.
Dave, let me ask a question of you based on what Tom just said. I know we've talked before about how people worrying too much about flying other people's airplanes and forgetting about flying their own. Going into Oshkosh, how much should somebody worry about the airplane behind them? You know, in Tom's case, there was an airplane coming in that was actually deviating from the procedure. I mean, they were coming in way faster than they should have been. It sounds like if they were going to fly fast, they should have even been in a higher pattern because you were in the lower pattern as well. And that may have been a save right there, paying attention to the aircraft behind you. What's the balance at Oshkosh where you've got so many other airplanes?
That's a good one, because how are you going to fly 1,000 other airplanes? You know, right. there are so many around you. And to me, I just want to reinforce Kevin's point about the intent of these regulations. The intent is to get as many airplanes safely on the ground in the smallest amount of time, and turning inbound seems to, like, the to me the best way to accomplish that. You know, a question that occurs to me is, does ADS-B make things better or worse? Mm-hmm. You know, because it used to be that it would be turn off your traffic systems. That used to be the request. It's no longer that way. But what does the table think?
Yeah, Sarah, you had a point on that.
I think that ADS-B can often give people a false sense of security, that if somehow you don't see the traffic on ADS-B, then it doesn't exist. And so people can become over-reliant on those traffic systems or looking at the targets on ForeFlight, that they're failing to divide their attention outside the aircraft. And that's one thing that I did in my Cub, is that I don't have my ADS-B on when I arrive. I make sure that my head is outside 100% of the time, and I'm looking for traffic. And I've got a lot of windows in the Cub, so it's easier to get views behind me and to the side of me than, let's say, like the G36 Bonanza in this scenario. But I've made it a point that, hey, just because I see that there's no traffic there does not mean that there's no traffic there.
Yeah, and we talked to some of the controllers who work the show in developing the scenario, and they've begun to use ADS-B, but they've even said, you know, it's a supplemental to what they're doing, and they have to worry about being too reliant on it because it's so convenient, right, to see these airplanes. But they got to remind themselves that they're missing a whole bunch of airplanes on there. So they're really, that's not just for the pilots, that's even for ATC working the show.
Well, of course, in this last time in, which is the first time I've flown in with ADS-B, it saved my life because I saw that plane coming in. But my strategy for using ADS-B on this was, once I visually acquired the aircraft I was following, that made it pretty easy for me to judge what half a mile in trail is. We don't usually do that. And I was a little concerned. You know, this is the fourth time I've flown into Oshkosh, but I've flown in IFR. I've flown in several other different ways. But going in this time, I, for whatever reason, it was kind of a last-minute trip for me, and I was a little more concerned about it. I just decided that would be a really good way to verify what my spacing was. I don't have a lot of experience determining what half a mile looks like behind a Cessna 182.
Right. And two things about your experience, Tom, you know, I want to pull out. One, I had said before, the plane coming in behind you was basically not following the procedure. Right. And that was a hazard for everybody, not just you. The other was, you mentioned that had you not had that experience, your decision here today in the scenario, it might have turned inbound, but it changed the way you thought about it. For people who are listening to this who might be going into the show, what are some of the other things that people who've flown in have learned along the way that may have influenced how they do it, when you arrive, how you arrive, what you need to practice or not practice? What are the gotchas? Because people listening may be planning their trip to Oshkosh right now. Richard.
My first is, you need to chair fly that arrival over and over so you don't have to rely on that document at all. You can almost tell when you're flying behind somebody or you see traffic in there and they're trying to look down and reference the document. So that's the best thing you can do, is chair fly that thing over and over again.
Dave.
I've got to fly pretty much every different type of arrival into Oshkosh, and, you know, the warbird arrival, the high one, the low one, the seaplane one, you know, there. And I would recommend the seaplane one. There's no stress in that one. It's the by far the least. But as far as expectations, do not expect an orderly process. It is mayhem. And it is, you know, in this the scenarios, you know, sort of low ceiling part is the worst of the mayhem. Knowing that, my personal strategy is to try to be either the first or the last one in. If you're there ready to do the Fisk arrival the moment it opens, that's usually pretty light traffic. And also, if you're the last one in the evening, if you're right before it closes, you know, that's usually pretty light. Right. You just try to, you know, use some common sense, avoid the high traffic times. Sometimes it's impossible, you know, whether in the days leading up to it or your own deadlines. But it's like, do not expect an orderly process. Do not ever expect everybody's going to be half a mile in trail. Everybody's got their horror stories of, you know, of pilots and bad behavior and ignorance. But just you just try to be ready for anything.
You know, you're not selling this arrival to Oshkosh thing really easily. No, it can
vary so much, because sometimes it's stress-free and fun and delightful, and other times it's a zoo. You just gotta, you know, you're right, I'm not selling it because I'm not trying to sell it. You know, I mean, it's like I'm just trying to be realistic.
Sarah.
And seconding what Dave is saying, there are times where I've been almost the only person flying in, and they'll have a conversation with you. Oh, where are you from? Or, you know, how long have you had the Cub or something like that? And so there's picking your timing can be really important too, especially if you're new to flying into Oshkosh. I'm not saying that I wouldn't do option four, which is depart the hold and find a quiet area until things settle down. But it's not a bad option, too. If you're too overwhelmed to continue in that hold or to continue inbound, go to fly to one of the nearby airports and wait that 45 minutes until the Congo line starts to die down, and then just join like any other aircraft. If they're holding at Puckaway Lake, which I've never been to Oshkosh and seen them hold at Puckaway Lake because I, once again, time my arrivals and I'm usually not arriving on Sunday or Monday. That being said, if they're already holding at Puckaway Lake, that means they are saturated in all the other lakes, all the other points leading up to Oshkosh. So that means that traffic is at an all-time high. So maybe the prudent decision would be, hey, if it's just too crazy right now and you see that everybody is just holding and all over the place, maybe wait until things settle down a little bit.
In this scenario, you said, Dave, that the weather is kind of the worst setup. And part of that is probably because it's compressed the high hold for the faster aircraft down. That's basically off the table. So everybody's down low and everybody's flying slowly. One of the things that comes up for people who have an aircraft like a Bonanza is, well, where do I belong? Do I belong in the higher hold? Do I belong in the lower hold? And people saying, I can't fly my Bonanza at 90 knots. And like, you know, Cirrus pilots often say the same thing because they can kind of fit in the same position, and some are perfectly comfortable and some are not. Tom, you're the Bonanza expert here.
Well, I flew it at 90 knots and 1,800 feet this last time, and I think the reason I did that is that the prior time I flew in IFR, I had to be IFR. The time before that, I flew a turbocharged Baron in, and I flew the high route. And somewhere outside of Ripon, I was told, descend down to the 1,800 foot level, and I was number two behind a steerman. And so just because you're in the high route doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to be in the fray eventually. Either one is appropriate, and either one can work out in the airplane I flew in.
Sarah.
And seconding what Tom said, I flew my Baron in there this year, and I did the high route as a faster aircraft. And I remember they put me behind a 172. So that being said, let's say that you are the G36 Bonanza and you're flying at 90 knots and you have somebody behind you who's really much faster and trying to slow it down. And that could also create an issue as well, because some people might be on the verge of being able to hold 90 knots while other people are at full throttle to hold 90 knots.
Right. Tom.
I'm going to help Dave with the sales job here and come back to Jeff's question as well. When I was getting ready for this flight in this year, I was a little more nervous, I think, than I had been in previous years thinking about it. And then it occurred to me, flying for a long distance at 90 knots at the same altitude as an airplane ahead of me and an airplane behind me is just a busy Saturday in the VFR traffic pattern back home. It's what you do all of the time. So if you know how to fly the airplane at those airspeeds, it's sort of a non-issue. The second thing is, I wrote about that experience I had this year in my blog and a couple of other places, and I had one of my readers ask me, well, have you ever heard of a midair collision on the approach to Oshkosh? And I can't find any evidence that it's ever happened. We do make it work. As Richard said, there's technique to this procedure, and we do make it work. Back to Jeff's question, the thing that you need to practice, the real risk, the thing that happens in the accident reports all of the time every year, is inaccurate landings and loss of directional control on the runway, especially making spot landings even with a slight tailwind component, because you have to be practiced and ready for that if you're going to fly into Oshkosh.
So that's absolutely something to practice, is spot landings. You mentioned the traffic pattern. I think that's a really interesting one too for a pilot who's never seen half a mile in trail. One great tip that I got was, you know, do pattern practice, or at least envision with a, say, 3,000-foot runway, or even better, if you have a 6,000-foot runway, if you're midfield downwind on a 6,000-foot runway, envision an airplane ahead of you that's a beam the numbers. That's half a mile. And all of us have had that experience. Like, oh, that's what an airplane half a mile away from me looks like. And if you haven't had that, you can go up with a friend or something, or just go up on a busy day in a pattern and be like, okay, I see what that looks like. So you have a sense of what that is, because we don't normally think about it that way as a pilot. There are, you know, just like the spot landings, it's an unusual thing to do. Dave?
Another tip for planning your arrival at Oshkosh is avoid the time of the mass arrivals. You know, they'll have the Cessnas to Oshkosh, the Bonanzas to Oshkosh, the Moonies to Oshkosh, and they are just clouds of mayhem, and if you can avoid those times, you're doing yourself a favor.
To the two folks at the table who have never been, but obviously know stuff about this, are there things you've wondered going into Oshkosh that you've been like, what is this like? Or is there just, there's so much information available? Have you watched the videos on YouTube? And see, everyone, you're nodding here, and that's the interesting thing, is the experience is so available outside of the actual experience, both the kinds of things we're talking about practicing, but also watching videos. I want to make a shout out to SimVenture. If you're a sim pilot, SimVenture is amazing. They actually run arrivals into a virtual Oshkosh with live ATC, with actual controllers who have worked the show, working virtual aircraft from all over the world on their simulators with the scenery that would be there, custom scenery. So you, if you have a decent simulator, you can actually see all the waypoints and walk through it and practice in a no-stress situation, you know. And even the SimVenture videos are out there for people to watch if they want to try that. And it's a great way to go, even if you can't go. The one thing that I had in my notes here that you mentioned, Sarah, that I think is really important too, is just about fuel, right? Showing up at Oshkosh in terms of fuel. And you're nodding as well, Tom. I can see you. That's a huge nod. What do people need to know about their fuel state going into Oshkosh? Or Sarah, go ahead.
I can say that from all my years of flying into Oshkosh, I have definitely heard more than one minimum fuel or emergency fuel being called on the radio. And to me, that's something that's easily preventable. It's not like we're in the middle of nowhere in Alaska where your nearest airport with fuel is 200 miles away. There's plenty of airports nearby that have gas, and it's probably going to be cheaper than what they charged at the show. So if there's anything I can really stress on, it's, hey, make sure that you have a lot of gas for anything that's unexpected.
The other factor potentially in this scenario is we've got two pilots, and that's also a common scenario going into Oshkosh, where, you know, I've got the pilot who is one of the co-owners. We haven't really talked about the fact that there's a co-owner, like, knows the airplane, sitting in the right seat. How do you coordinate with another person in this kind of environment where decisions need to be made potentially, like, immediately here, right? How do you divide up the duties? Normally different, Kevin.
I think you have a great tool as long as you use it the right way. And in order to utilize that CRM appropriately, I think the conversation needs to be had way before you get anywhere near Wisconsin going into Oshkosh or any busy airport. The thought process applies if you're flying to a busy Class B airport or anywhere where there's a lot going on, and it's what is expected of the two people and how they're going to help each other out.
I want to go all the way back to the beginning to what you said, Sarah, and what Richard picked up on and Tom had mentioned about the intersection of the procedure and the judgment in the moment, finding that balance between you and what's happening around you. And Tom, you made a great point. It's amazing there aren't collisions. And I also don't know of one. I know of collisions on the ground, but collisions in the air. And it's not because of exceptional pilot skill. They're definitely not. And it's not because of technology, although that may play a role. It's about some kind of common agreement to fly a procedure that keeps us safe and a respect for working with other people's decisions and maneuvering about them in a common space. So yeah, if you go, and I encourage you to go, if it's a madhouse, step out until it calms down, but don't give up completely, because it's worth it to do it at least once.